Sebastian drew aside the dusty velvet curtain that closed off the alcove and smiled. A bench ran around the inside of the small circular room, and a man sat there, leaning his elbows on a stone table. He had long black hair tied back, a scar or a mark in the shape of a leaf on his cheek, and his eyes were as green as grass. He wore a white suit, and a handkerchief with green leaf embroidery peeked from one pocket.
"Jonathan Morgenstern?" Meliorn said.
Sebastian did not correct him. Freys took great stock in names and would never call him by anything but the name his father had chosen for him. "I wasn't sure you would be here at the appointed time, Meliorn."
"May I remind you that the fair folk do not lie," said the knight.
He reached up and twitched the curtain shut behind Sebastian. The pounding music outside was discreetly muffled, though by no means inaudible. "Come in, then, and seat yourself.
Wine?"
Sebastian settled himself on the bench. "No, nothing." Wine, like the fairy liquor, would only cloud his thoughts, and fairies seemed to have a higher tolerance. "I admit, I was surprised when I received the message that you wished to meet here. You, above all, should know that the lady has a special interest in you. She knows of all your movements." Meliorn took a sip of wine. "There was a great demonic disturbance here in Prague tonight. The queen was concerned." Sebastian spread his arms out. "As you can see, I am unharmed. A disturbance so great will surely win the attention of the Nephilim. In fact, if I am not mistaken, several of them already disport themselves without."
"Without what?" Sebastian asked innocently.
Meliorn took another sip of wine and glared. "Oh, right. I always forget the amusing way fairies talk. You mean there are shadow hunters in the crowd outside, looking for me?" "I know that. I noticed them earlier. The queen does not think much of me if she does not think I can handle a few Nephilim on my own." Sebastian drew a dagger from his belt and twirled it, the very little light in the alcove sparking off the blade.
"I shall tell her you said so," muttered Meliorn.
"I must admit, I have no idea what attraction you hold for her. I have taken your measure and found it lacking, but I have not my lady's taste."
"Weighed in the balance and found wanting?"
Amused, Sebastian leaned forward. "Let me break it down for you, fairy knight. I'm young, I'm pretty, and I'm willing to burn the whole world to the ground to get what I want." His dagger traced a crack in the stone table. "Like myself, the queen is content to play a long game. But what I desire to know is this. When the twilight of the Nephilim comes, will the court stand with or against me?"
Meliorn's face was blank.
"The lady says she stands with you." Sebastian's mouth curled at the corner. "That is excellent news."
Meliorn snorted. "I always presumed the race of humans would end themselves," he said.
"Through 1,000 years I have prophesied that you would be your own deaths. But I did not expect the end to come like this."
Sebastian twirled the bright dagger between his fingers.
"No one ever does." "Chase," Clary whispered. "Chase, anyone could come in and see us."
His hands didn't stop what they were doing.
"They won't." He trailed a path of kisses down her neck, effectively scattering her thoughts. It was hard to hold on to what was real with his hands on her, and her mind and memories in a whirl. And her fingers were so tightly bunched in Jace's shirt, she was sure she was going to rip the material. The stone wall was cold against her back, but Jace was kissing her shoulder, easing the strap of her dress down. She was hot and cold and shivering. The world had fractured into bits, like the bright pieces inside a kaleidoscope. She was going to come apart under his hands.
"Jace."
She clung to his shirt. It was sticky, viscous. She glanced down at her hands, and for a moment didn't comprehend what she saw there. Silver fluid mixed with red.
blood. She looked up, hanging upside down from the ceiling above them, like a grisly pinata, was a human body, rope binding its ankles. Blood dripped from its cut throat. Clary screamed, but the scream made no sound. She pushed at Jace, who stumbled back. There was blood in his hair, on his shirt, on her bare skin. She pulled up the straps of her dress and stumbled to the curtain that hid the alcove, yanking it open. The statue of the angel was no longer quite as it had been. The black wings were bat's wings. The lovely, benevolent face twisted into a sneer. Dangling from the ceiling on twisted ropes were the slaughtered bodies of men, women, animals. Slashed open, their blood dripping down like rain. The fountains pulsed blood, and what floated on top of the liquid was not flowers, but open, severed hands. The writhing, clawing dancers on the floor were drenched in blood. As Clary watched, a couple spun by, the man tall and pale, the woman limp in his arms, her throat torn, obviously dead. The man licked his lips and bent down for another bite. But before he did, he glanced at Clary and grinned, and his face was streaked with blood and silver. She felt Jace's hand on her arm, tugging her back, but she fought free of him. She was staring at the glass tanks along the wall that she had thought held brilliant fish. The water was not clear, but blackish and sludgy, and drowned human bodies floated in it, their hair spinning around them like the filaments of luminous jellyfish. She thought of Sebastian floating in his glass coffin. A scream rose in her throat, but she choked it back as silence and darkness overwhelmed her. Chapter 14. As Ashes. Clary came back to consciousness slowly, with the dizzy sensation she recalled from that first morning in the Institute, when she had woken with no idea of where she was. Her whole body ached, and her head felt as if someone had smashed an iron barbell into it. She was lying on her side, her head pillowed on something rough, and there was a weight around her shoulder. Glancing down, she saw a slim hand pressed protectively against her sternum. She recognized the marks, the faint white scars, even the blue mapping of veins across his forearm. The weight inside her chest eased, and she sat up carefully, slipping out from under Jace's arm. They were in his bedroom. She recognized the incredible neatness, the carefully made bed with its hospital corners. It still wasn't disarranged. Jace was asleep, propped up against the headboard, still in the same clothes he'd worn the night before. He even had his shoes on. He had clearly fallen asleep holding her, though she had no recollection of it. He was still splattered with the odd silvery substance from the club. He stirred slightly, as if sensing that she was gone, and wrapped his free arm around himself. He didn't look injured or hurt, she thought, just exhausted. His long, dark gold eyelashes curled in the hollow of the shadows beneath his eyes. He looked vulnerable asleep, a little boy. He could have been her Jace. But he wasn't. She remembered the nightclub, his hands on her in the dark, the bodies in blood. Her stomach churned, and she put a hand over her mouth, swallowing down nausea. She felt sickened by what she remembered, and underneath the sickness was a nagging prickle, the sense that she was missing something. Something important. Clary? She turned. Jace's eyes were half open. He was looking at her through his lashes, the gold of his eyes dulled with exhaustion. Why are you awake? He said. It's barely dawn. Her hands bunched in the tangle of blankets. Last night, she said, her voice uneven. The bodies. The blood. The what? That's what I saw. He shook his head. Fairy drugs, he said. You knew. It seems so real. I'm sorry. His eyes closed. I wanted to have fun. It's supposed to make you happy, make you see pretty things. I thought we would have fun together. I saw blood, she said, and dead people floating in tanks. He shook his head, his lashes fluttering down. None of it was real. Even what happened with you and me? Clary broke off because his eyes were closed, his chest rising and falling steadily. He was asleep. She rose to her feet, not looking at Jace, and went into the bathroom. She stood, looking at herself in the mirror, numbness spreading through her bones. She was covered in smears of silver residue. It reminded her of the time a metallic pin had burst inside her backpack, ruining everything in it. One of her bra straps had snapped, probably where Jace had yanked on it the night before. Her eyes were surrounded with smeared black stripes of mascara, and her skin and hair were sticky with silver. Feeling faint and sick, she stripped off the slip dress and her underwear, tossing them into the wastebasket before crawling into the hot water. She washed her hair over and over again, trying to get the dried silver gunk out. It was like trying to wash out oil paint. The scent of it lingered, too, like the water from a vase after the flowers have rotted, faint and sweet and spoiled on her skin. No amount of soap seemed to be able to get rid of it. Finally, convinced she was as clean as she was going to get, she dried off and went to the master bedroom to get dressed. It was a relief to climb back into jeans and boots and slip on a comfortable cotton sweater. It was only then, as she pulled on her second boot, that the nagging feeling returned, the feeling that she was missing something. She froze. Her ring. The gold ring that let her speak to Simon. It was gone. Frantically, she searched for it, tearing through the wastebasket to see if the ring had gotten caught on her dress, then searching every inch of Jace's room while he slept peacefully on. She combed through the carpet, the bedclothes, checking the nightstand drawers. At last she sat back, her heart slamming against her chest, a sick feeling in her stomach. The ring was gone. Lost. Somewhere, somehow. She tried to remember the last time she'd seen it. Surely it had flashed on her hand while she'd wielded the dagger against the Elipid demons. Had it fallen off in the junk store? In the nightclub? She dug her nails into her blue-jeaned thighs until the pain made her gasp. Focus, she told herself. Focus. Maybe the ring had fallen from her finger somewhere else in the apartment. Probably Jace had carried her upstairs at some point. It was a small chance, but every chance had to be explored. She rose to her feet and went as soundlessly as she could out into the hallway. She moved toward Sebastian's room and hesitated. She couldn't imagine why the ring would be in there, and waking him up would only be counterproductive. She turned around and made her way down the stairs instead, walking carefully to mask the sound of her boots. Her mind was racing. With no way to contact Simon, what was she going to do? She needed to tell him about the antiques shop, the Adamus. She should have talked to him sooner. She wanted to punch the wall, but she forced her mind to slow down, to consider her options. Sebastian and Jace were beginning to trust her. If she could get away from them briefly, on a busy city street, she could use a payphone to call Simon. She could duck into an internet cafe and email him. She knew more about mundane technology than they did. Losing the ring didn't mean it was over. She would not give up. Her mind was so occupied with thoughts of what to do next that at first she didn't see Sebastian. Fortunately, he had his back to her. He stood in the living room, facing the wall. Already at the bottom of the staircase, Clary froze, then darted across the floor and flattened herself against the half wall that separated the kitchen from the larger room. There was no reason to panic, she told herself. She lived here. If Sebastian saw her, she could say she'd come downstairs for a glass of water. But the chance to observe him without his knowledge was too tempting. She turned her body slightly, peering over and around the kitchen counter. Sebastian still had his back to her. He had changed his clothes since the nightclub. The army jacket was gone. He wore a button-down shirt and jeans. As he turned and his shirt lifted, she could see that his weapon belt was slung around his waist. As he raised his right hand, she saw that he held his steely. And there was something about the way he held it, just for a moment, with a careful thoughtfulness, that reminded her of the way her mother held a paintbrush. She closed her eyes. It felt like fabric snagging on a hook, the jerk inside her heart when she recognized something in Sebastian that reminded her of her mother or herself. That reminded her that however much of his blood was poison, just as much was the same blood that ran in her own veins. She opened her eyes again, in time to see a doorway form in front of Sebastian. He reached for a scarf that hung on a peg on the wall and stepped out into the darkness. Clary had a split second to decide, stay and search the rooms, or follow Sebastian and see where he was going. Her feet made the choice before her mind did. Spinning away from the wall, she darted through the dark opening of the door moments before it closed behind her. The room Luke was lying in was lit only by a streetlight's glow, which came through the slatted windows. Jocelyn knew she could have asked for a light, but she preferred it like this. The darkness hid the extent of his injuries, the pallor of his face, the sunken crescents beneath his eyes. In fact, in the dimness, he looked very like the boy she had known in Idris before the circle had been formed. She remembered him in the schoolyard, skinny and brown-haired, with blue eyes and nervous hands. He'd been Valentine's best friend, and because of that, no one had ever really looked at him. Even she hadn't, or she would not have been so enormously blind as to miss his feelings for her. She remembered the day of her wedding to Valentine, the sun bright and clear through the crystal roof of the Accords Hall. She'd been 19 and Valentine 20, and she remembered how unhappy her parents had been that she'd chosen to marry so young. Their disapproval had seemed like nothing to her. They didn't understand. She'd been so sure there would never be anyone for her but Valentine. Luke had been his best man. She remembered his face as she walked down the aisle. She had looked at him only briefly before turning her full attention to Valentine. She remembered thinking that he must not have been well, that he looked as if he were in pain. And later, in Angel Square, as the guests milled about, most of the members of the circle were there, from Maris and Robert Lightwood, already married, to barely 15 Jeremy Pontmercy, and she stood with Luke and Valentine. Someone made the old joke about how if the groom hadn't showed up, the bride would have had to marry the best man. Luke had been wearing evening clothes, with the gold runes for good luck and marriage on them, and he had looked very handsome. But while everyone else had laughed, he'd gone terribly white. "He must really hate the idea of marrying me," she thought. She remembered touching his shoulder with a laugh. "Don't look like that," she teased. "I know we've known each other forever, but I promise you'll never have to marry me." And then Amadis had come up, dragging a laughing Stephen with her, and Jocelyn had forgotten all about Luke, the way he had looked at her, and the odd way Valentine had looked at him. She glanced over at Luke now, and started in her chair. His eyes were open, for the first time in days, and fixed on her. "Luke," she breathed. He looked puzzled. "How long have I been asleep?" She wanted to throw herself onto him, but the thick bandages still wrapped around his chest held her back. She caught at his hand instead and put it against her cheek, her fingers interlocking with his. She closed her eyes, and as she did, felt tears slip from under her lids. About 3 days. Jocelyn, he said, sounding really alarmed now. Why are we at the station? Where's Clary? I really don't remember. She lowered their interlaced hands and, in as steady a voice as she could manage, told him what had happened. About Sebastian and Jace, and the demon metal embedded in his side, and the help of the Praetor Lupus. Clary, he said immediately, when she was finished, we have to go after her. Drawing his hand from hers, he started to struggle into a sitting position. Even in the dim light, she could see his pallor deepen as he winced with pain. That's not possible. Luke, lie back down, please. Don't you think if there were any way to go after her, I would have? He swung his legs over the side of the bed so he was sitting up. Then, with a gasp, he leaned back on his hands. He looked awful. But the danger! Do you think I haven't thought about the danger? Jocelyn put her hands on his shoulders and pushed him gently back against the pillows. Simon's been in contact with me every night. She's all right. She is. And you're in no shape to do anything about it. Killing yourself won't help her. Please trust me, Luke. Jocelyn, I can't just lie here. You can, she said, standing up. And you will, if I have to sit on you myself. What on earth is wrong with you, Lucien? Are you out of your mind? I'm terrified about Clary, and I've been terrified about you, too. Please don't do this. Don't do this to me. If anything happened to you... He looked at her with surprise. There was already a red stain on the white bandages that wrapped his chest, where his movements had pulled his wound open. I... What? I'm not used to you loving me, he said. There was a meekness to his words that she didn't associate with Luke, and she stared at him for a moment before she said, Luke, lie back down, please. As a sort of compromise, he leaned further back against the pillows. He was breathing hard. Jocelyn darted to the nightstand, poured him a glass of water, and returning, thrust it into his hand. Drink it, she said, please. Luke took the glass, his blue eyes following her as she sat back down in the chair beside his bed, from which she had barely moved for so many hours that she was surprised she and the chair hadn't become one. You know what I was thinking about? She asked, just before you woke up. He took a sip of the water. He looked very far away. I was thinking about the day I married Valentine. Luke lowered the glass. The worst day of my life. Worse than the day you got bitten? She asked, folding her legs up under her. Worse. I didn't know, she said. I didn't know how you felt. I wish I had. I think things would have been different. He looked at her incredulously. How? I wouldn't have married Valentine, she said. Not if I'd known. You would. I wouldn't, she said sharply. I was too stupid to realize how you felt, but I was also too stupid to realize how I felt. I've always loved you, even if I didn't know it. She leaned forward and kissed him gently, not wanting to hurt him. Then she put her cheek against his. Promise me you won't put yourself in danger. Promise. She felt his free hand in her hair. I promise. She leaned back, partly satisfied. I wish I could go back in time, fix everything, marry the right guy. But then we wouldn't have Clary, he reminded her. She loved the way he said we, so casually, as if there were no doubt at all in his mind that Clary was his daughter. If you'd been there more while she was growing up, Jocelyn sighed. I just feel like I did everything wrong. I was so focused on protecting her that I think I protected her too much. She rushes headlong into danger without thinking. When we were growing up, we saw our friends die in battle. She never has. And I wouldn't want that for her, but sometimes I worry that she doesn't believe she can die.
Jocelyn, Luke's voice was soft. You raised her to be a good person. Someone with values, who believes in good and evil and strives to be good, like you always have. You can't raise a child to believe the opposite of what you do. I don't think she doesn't believe she can die. I think, just like you always did, she believes there are things worth dying for.
Clary crept after Sebastian through a network of narrow streets, keeping to the shadows close beside the buildings. They were no longer in Prague, that much was immediately clear. The roads were dark. The sky above was the hollow blue of a very early morning, and the signs hung above the shops and stores she passed were all in French, as were the street signs, Rue de la Seine, Rue Jacob, Rue de l'Abbaye. As they moved through the city, people passed her like ghosts. The occasional car rumbled by, trucks backed up to stores, making early morning deliveries. The air smelled like river water and trash. She was fairly sure where they were already, but then a turn and an alley took them to a wide avenue, and a signpost loomed up out of the misty darkness. Arrows pointed in different directions, showing the way to the Bastille, to Notre Dame, and to the Latin Quarter. Paris, Clary thought, slipping behind a parked car as Sebastian crossed the street. We're in Paris. It was ironic. She'd always wanted to go to Paris with someone who knew the city, had always wanted to walk its streets, to see the river, to paint the buildings. She'd never imagined this. Never imagined creeping after Sebastian across the boulevard Saint-Germain, past a bright yellow Bureau de Poste, up an avenue where the bars were closed but the gutters were full of beer bottles and cigarette butts, and down a narrow street lined with houses. Sebastian stopped before one, and Clary froze as well, flat against a wall. She watched as he raised a hand and punched a code into a box set beside the door. Her eyes followed the movements of his fingers. There was a click, the door opened, and he slipped through. The moment it closed, she darted after him, pausing to key in the same code, X235, and waiting to hear the soft sound that meant the door was unlocked. When the sound came, she wasn't sure if she was more relieved or surprised. It shouldn't be this easy. A moment later, she stood inside a courtyard. It was square, surrounded on all sides by ordinary-looking buildings. Three staircases were viewable through open doors. Sebastian, however, had disappeared. So it wasn't going to be that easy. She moved forward into the courtyard, conscious as she did so that she was bringing herself out of sheltering shadow and into the open, where she could be seen. The sky was lightening with every passing moment. The knowledge that she was visible prickled the back of her neck, and she ducked into the shadow of the first stairwell she encountered. It was plain, with wooden stairs leading up and down, and a cheap mirror on the wall in which she could see her own pale face. There was a distinct smell of rotting garbage, and she wondered for a moment if she were near where the trash bins were stored, before her tired mind clicked over and she realized. The stink was the presence of demons. Her tired muscles started to shake, but she tightened her hands into fists. She was painfully conscious of her lack of weaponry. She took a deep breath of the stinking air and began to make her way down the steps. The smell grew stronger and the air darker as she made her way downstairs, and she wished for a steely and a night vision rune. But there was nothing to be done about it. She kept going as the staircase curved around and around, and she was suddenly grateful for the lack of light as she stepped in a patch of something sticky. She clutched for the banister and tried to breathe through her mouth. The darkness thickened until she was walking blind, her heart pounding so loudly she was sure it must be announcing her presence. The streets of Paris, the ordinary world, seemed eons away. There was only the darkness in herself, going down and down and down. And then, light flared in the distance, a tiny point like the tip of a match bursting into flame. She moved closer to the banister, almost crouching as the light grew. She could see her own hand now, and the outline of the steps below her. There were only a few more. She reached the bottom of the stairs and glanced around. Any resemblance to an ordinary apartment building was gone. Somewhere along the way, the wooden stairs had turned into stone, and she stood now in a small stone-walled room lit by a torch that gave off a sickly greenish light. The floor was rock, polished smooth, and carved with multiple strange symbols. She edged around them as she crossed the room to the only other exit, a curved stone arch, at the apex of which was set a human skull between the V of two enormous ornamental crossed axes. Through the archway, she could hear voices. They were too distant for her to make out what they were saying, but they were voices nonetheless. "This way," they seemed to say. "Follow us." She stared up at the skull, and its empty eyes gazed back at her mockingly. She wondered where she was, if Paris was still above her, or if she had stepped into another world entirely, the way one did when one entered the silent city. She thought of Jace, whom she had left sleeping in what now seemed like another life. She was doing this for him, she reminded herself, to get him back. She stepped through the arch into the corridor beyond, instinctively flattening herself against the wall. Soundlessly, she crept along, the voices growing louder and louder. It was dim in the hall, but not lightless. Every few feet, another greenish torch burned, giving off a charred odor. A door opened suddenly in the wall to her left, and the voices grew louder.
"Not like his father,"
one said, the words as raspy as sandpaper.
"Valentine would not deal with us at all. He would make slaves of us. This one will give us this world."
Very slowly, Clary peered around the edge of the doorway. The room was bare, smooth-walled, and empty of all furniture. Inside it was a group of demons. They were lizard-like, with hard green-brown skin, but each had a set of six octopus-like legs that made a dry, skittering sound as they moved. Their heads were bulbous, alien, set with faceted black eyes. She swallowed bile. She was reminded of the Ravener that had been one of the first demons she'd ever seen. Something about the grotesque combination of lizard, insect, and alien made her stomach turn. She pressed closer to the wall, listening hard.
"That is, if you trust him."
It was hard to tell which of them was talking. Their legs clenched and unclenched as they moved, raising and lowering their bulbous bodies. They didn't seem to have mouths, but clusters of small tentacles that vibrated as they spoke.
"The Great Mother trusted him. He is her child."
Sebastian. Of course they were talking about Sebastian.
"He is also Nephilim. They are our great enemies. They are his enemies as well. He bears the blood of Lilith. But the one he calls his companion bears the blood of our enemies. He is of the angels."
The word was spat with such hate that Clary felt it like a slap.
"Lilith's child assures us he has him well in hand, and indeed he seems obedient."
A dry, insectal chuckle.
"You young ones are too consumed with worry. The Nephilim have long kept this world from us. Its riches are great. We will drink it dry and leave it as ashes. As for the angel boy, he will be the last of his kind to die. We will burn him on a pyre until he is only golden bones."
Rage rose in Clary. She sucked in a breath, a tiny sound, but a sound. The demon nearest her jerked its head up. For a moment, Clary froze, trapped in the glare of its mirrored black eyes. Then she turned and ran back toward the entryway and the stairs and their path up into the darkness. She could hear commotion behind her, the creature screaming, and then the slithering, skittering noise of them coming after her. She cast one glance over her shoulder and realized she wasn't going to make it. Despite her head start, they were almost on her. She could hear her own harsh breathing, sawing in and out, as she reached the archway, spun, and leaped to catch hold of it with her hands. She swung herself forward with all her force, her booted feet driving into the first of the demons, knocking it backward as it shrilled loudly. Still dangling, she caught at the handle of one of the crossed axes below the skull and yanked. Stuck fast, it didn't move. She closed her eyes, gripping it tighter, and with all her strength, pulled. The axe came away from the wall with a rending sound, showering down rocks and mortar. Unbalanced, Clary fell and landed in a crouch, the axe held out in front of her. It was heavy, but she barely felt it. It was happening again, what had happened in the junk shop. The slowing of time, the increased intensity of sensation. She could feel every whisper of the air against her skin, every unevenness of the ground under her feet. She braced herself as the first of the demons scuttled through the doorway and reared back like a tarantula, its legs pawing the air above her. Beneath the tentacles on its face were a pair of long, dripping fangs. The axe in her hand seemed to swing forward of its own accord, sinking deep into the creature's chest. She immediately remembered Jace telling her not to go for the chest wound, but for the decapitation. Not all demons had hearts. But in this case, she was lucky. She had struck either the heart or some other vital organ. The creature thrashed and squealed. Blood bubbled up around the wound, and then it vanished, leaving her to reel back a step, her Ikor slicked weapon in her hand. The demon's blood was black and stinking like tar. As the next one lunged for her, she ducked low, swinging out with the axe and slicing through several of its legs. Howling, it tipped sideways like a broken chair. Already, the next demon was trampling over its body, trying to get to her. She swung again, her axe burying itself in the creature's face, and she darted backward, pressing herself up against the stairwell. If one of them got around behind her, she was dead. Maddened, the demon whose face she'd slashed open lurched at her again. She swung out with her axe, severing one of its legs, but another leg wrapped itself around her wrist. Hot agony shot up her arm. She screamed and tried to wrench her hand back, but the demon's grip was too strong. It felt as if thousands of hot needles were stabbing into her skin. Still screaming, she drove out with her left arm, slamming her fist into the creature's face, where her axe had already sliced it. The demon gave a hiss and loosed its grip fractionally. She wrenched her hand free just as it reared back, and out of nowhere, a shimmering blade drove down, burying itself in the demon's skull. As she stared, the demon vanished, and she saw her brother, a blazing serif blade in his hand, ichor splattered across his white shirt front. Behind him, the room was empty, save for the body of one of the demons, still twitching, but with black fluid pouring from its severed leg stumps like oil from a smashed car. Sebastian. She stared at him in amazement. Had he just saved her life? "Get away from me, Sebastian," she hissed. He didn't seem to hear her. "Your arm." She glanced down at her right wrist, still throbbing in agony. A thick band of saucer-shaped wounds encircled it where the demon suckers had fastened themselves to her skin. Already the wounds were darkening, turning a sickening blue-black. She looked back up at her brother. His white hair looked like a halo in the darkness, or it might have been the fact that her vision was going. Light was haloing around the green torch on the wall, too, and around the serif blade burning in Sebastian's hand. He was talking, but his words were blurred, indistinct, as if he were speaking underwater. "Deadly poison," he was saying. "What the hell were you thinking, Clarissa?" His voice faded out and back in again. She struggled to focus. "To fight off six Dahak demons with an ornamental axe?" Poison, she repeated, and for a moment his face came clear again, the lines of strain around his mouth and eyes pronounced and startling. So I guess you didn't save my life after all, did you? Her hand spasmed, and the axe slid out of her grip, clattering to the ground. She felt her sweater catch on the rough wall as she began to slide down it, wanting nothing more than to lie on the floor. But Sebastian wouldn't let her rest. His arms were under hers, lifting her up, and then he was carrying her, her good arm slung around his neck. She wanted to struggle away from him, but her energy had deserted her. She felt a stinging pain on the inside of her elbow, a burn, a touch of a steely. Numbness spread through her veins. The last thing she saw before she closed her eyes was the face of the skull in the archway. She could have sworn its hollow eyes were full of laughter. Chapter 15. Magdalena. Nausea and pain came and went in ever-tightening whirlpools. Clary could see only a blur of colors around her. She was conscious that her brother was carrying her, every one of his steps slamming into her skull like an ice pick. She was aware that she was clinging to him, and the strength of his arms a comfort, that it was bizarre that anything about Sebastian would be a comfort, and that he seemed to be taking care not to jostle her too much as he walked. Very distantly, she knew that she was gasping for breath, and she heard her brother say her name. Then everything went silent. For a moment she thought that was the end of it. She had died. Died battling demons the way most shadow hunters did. Then she felt another pricking burn on the inside of her arm, and a surge of what felt like ice spilling through her veins. She squeezed her eyes shut against the pain, but the cold of whatever Sebastian had done to her was like having a glass of water dashed in your face. Slowly, the world ceased its spinning, the whirlpools of nausea and pain lessening until they were only ripples in the tide of her blood. She could breathe again. With a gasp, she opened her eyes. Blue sky. She was lying on her back, staring up at an endless blue sky, touched with cottony clouds, like the painted sky on the ceiling of the infirmary in the Institute. She stretched out her aching arms. The right one still bore the marks of her bracelet of injuries, though they were fading to a light pink. On her left arm was an arazi, paling to invisibility, and there was a mandolin for pain in the crook of her elbow. She took a deep breath, autumn air tinged with the smell of leaves. She could see the tops of trees, hear the murmur of traffic, and... Sebastian. She heard a low chuckle and realized she was lying propped against her brother. Sebastian, who was warm and breathing and whose arm cradled her head. The rest of her was stretched out along a slightly damp wooden bench. She jerked upright. Sebastian laughed again. He was sitting at the end of a park bench with elaborate iron armrests. His scarf was folded up in his lap where she'd been lying, and the arm that hadn't been cradling her head was stretched out along the back of the bench. He had unbuttoned his white shirt to hide the ichor stains. Beneath it, he wore a plain gray t-shirt. The silver bracelet glittered on his wrist. His black eyes studied her with amusement as she scooted as far away from him on the bench as she could get. "Good thing you're so short," he said. "If you were much taller, carrying you would have been extremely inconvenient." She kept her voice steady with an effort. "Where are we?" "The Jardin de Luxembourg," he said. "The Luxembourg Gardens. It's a very nice park. I had to take you somewhere you could lie down. In the middle of the street didn't seem like a good idea." "Yeah, there's a word for leaving someone to die in the middle of the street. Vehicular manslaughter." "That's two words. And I think it's only vehicular manslaughter technically if you run them over yourself." He rubbed his hands together as if to warm them. "Anyway, why would I leave you to die in the middle of the street after I went through all that effort to save your life?" She swallowed and looked down at her arm. The wounds were even more faded now. If she hadn't known to look for them, she probably wouldn't have noticed them at all. Why did you?
Why did I what?
Save my life. You're my sister. She swallowed. In the morning light, his face had some color in it. There were faint burns along his neck where the demon ichor had splashed him.
You never cared that I was your sister before.
Didn't I? His black eyes flicked up and down her. She remembered when Jace had come into her house after she'd fought the Ravener demon and she'd been dying of the poison. He'd cured her, just as Sebastian had, and carried her out the same way. Maybe they were more alike than she had ever wanted to think, even before the spell that had bound them. Our father's dead, he said. There are no other relatives. You and I, we are the last of the Morgensterns. You are my only chance for someone whose blood runs in my veins, too. Someone like me. You knew I was following you, she said.
Of course I did.
And you let me.
I wanted to see what you would do.
And I admit, I didn't think you would follow me down there. You're braver than I thought. He picked up the scarf from his lap and drew it around his neck. The park was beginning to fill up, with tourists clutching maps, parents with children in hand, old men sitting on other benches like this one, smoking pipes.
You would never have won that fight.
I might have. He grinned, a quick sideways grin, as if he couldn't help it.
Maybe.
She scuffed her boots in the grass, which was wet with dew. She wasn't going to thank Sebastian. Not for anything.
Why are you dealing with demons? She demanded.
I listened to them talking about you. I know what you're doing.
No, you don't.
The grin was gone, the superior tone back. First, those weren't the demons I was dealing with. Those were their guards. That's why they were in the separate room and why I wasn't there. Dahak demons aren't that smart, though they are mean and tough and defensive. So it's not like they were really informed about what was going on. They were just repeating gossip they'd heard from their masters. Greater demons. That was who I was meeting with.
And that's supposed to make me feel better?
He leaned toward her across the bench.
I'm not trying to make you feel better. I'm trying to tell you the truth.
No wonder you look like you're having an allergy attack, she said. Though it wasn't precisely true. Sebastian looked annoyingly tranquil, though the set of his jaw and the pulse in his temple told her he wasn't as calm as he pretended. The Dahak said you were going to give this world to the demons.
Now, does that sound like something I'd do?
She just looked at him.
I thought you said you were going to give me a chance, he said.
I'm not who I was when you met me in Alicante. His gaze was clear. Besides, I'm not the only person you've ever met who believed in Valentine. He was my father. Our father. It's not easy to doubt the things you've grown up believing. Clary crossed her arms over her chest. The air was fresh but cold, with a wintry snap in it.
Well, that's true.
Valentine was wrong, he said. He was so obsessed with the wrongs he believed the Clave had done to him that he could see nothing past proving himself right to them. He wanted the angel to rise and tell them that he was Jonathan Shadowhunter returned, that he was their leader, and his way was the right way.
It didn't exactly happen like that.
I know what happened. Lilith spoke to me of it. He said this offhandedly, as if conversations with the mother of all warlocks was something everyone had every once in a while. Do not fool yourself into thinking that what happened was because the angel has great compassion, Clary. Angels are as cold as icicles. Raziel was angered because Valentine had forgotten the mission of all shadow hunters.
Which is?
To kill demons. That is our mandate. Surely you must have heard that more and more demons have been spilling into our world in recent years. That we have no idea how to keep them out. An echo of words came back to her. Something Jace had said to her, what seemed like a lifetime ago, the first time they had ever visited the Silent City. We might be able to block them from coming here, but nobody's even been able to figure out how to do that. In fact, more and more of them are coming through. There used to be only small demon invasions into this world, easily contained. But even in my lifetime, more and more of them have spilled through the wardings. The Clave is always having to dispatch shadow hunters, and a lot of times, they don't come back. A great war with demons is coming, and the Clave is woefully unprepared, said Sebastian. That much my father was correct about. They are too set in their ways to hear warnings or to change. I do not wish the destruction of Downworlders as Valentine did, but I worry that the Clave's blindness will doom this world that Shadowhunters protect. You want me to believe you care if this world is destroyed? Well, I do live here, Sebastian said, more mildly than she would have expected. And sometimes extreme situations call for extreme measures. To destroy the enemy, it can be necessary to understand him, even to treat with him. If I can make those greater demons trust me, then I can lure them here, where they can be destroyed, and their followers as well. That ought to turn back the tide. Demons will know that this world is not as easy pickings as they imagined it. Cleary shook her head. And you're going to do this with what? Just you and Jace? You're pretty impressive, don't get me wrong, but even the two of you... Sebastian stood up. You really don't imagine I could have thought this through, do you? He looked down at her, the fall wind blowing his white hair across his face. Come with me. I want to show you something. She hesitated. Jace is still asleep. Trust me, I know. He held out his hand. Come with me, Clary. If I can't make you believe I have a plan, maybe I can prove it to you. She stared at him. Images tumbled through her mind like shaken confetti. The junk shop in Prague, her gold leaf ring falling away into darkness, Jace holding her in the alcove in the club, the glass tanks of dead bodies, Sebastian with a seraph blade in his grip. Prove it to you. She took his hand and let him pull her to her feet. It was decided, though not without a great deal of arguing, that in order for the summoning of Raziel to take place, Team Good would need to find a fairly secluded location. We can't summon a 60-foot angel in the middle of Central Park, Magnus observed dryly. People might notice, even in New York. Raziel's 60 feet tall? Isabel said. She was slumped down in an armchair she had pulled up to the table. There were rings under her dark eyes. She, like Alec, Magnus, and Simon, was exhausted. They had all been awake for hours, poring through books of Magnus's so old that their pages were as thin as onion skin. Both Isabel and Alec could read Greek and Latin, and Alec had a better knowledge of demon languages than Izzy did, but there were still many only Magnus could understand. Maya and Jordan, realizing they could be more help elsewhere, had left for the police station to check on Luke. Meanwhile, Simon had tried to make himself useful in other ways, getting food and coffee, copying down symbols as Magnus instructed, fetching more paper and pencils, and even feeding Chairman Meow, who had thanked him by coughing up a hairball on the floor of Magnus's kitchen. Actually, he's only 59 feet tall, but he likes to exaggerate, said Magnus. Tiredness was not improving his temper. His hair was sticking straight up, and there were smudges of glitter on the backs of his hands where he had rubbed his eyes. He's an angel, Isabel. Haven't you ever studied anything? Isabel clicked her tongue in annoyance. Valentine raised an angel in his cellar. I don't see why you need all this space. Because Valentine is just way more awesome than me, snapped Magnus, dropping his pen. Look. Don't shout at my sister, said Alec. He said it quietly, but with force behind the words. Magnus looked at him in surprise. Alec continued, "Isabel, the size of angels when they appear in the earthly dimension varies depending on their power. The angel Valentine summoned was of a lower rank than Raziel. And if you were to summon an angel of an even higher rank, Michael or Gabriel, I couldn't make a spell that would bind them, even momentarily," said Magnus in a subdued voice. "We're summoning Raziel in part because we're hoping that as the creator of Shadowhunters, he will have a special compassion, or really any compassion, for your situation. He's also of about the right rank. A less powerful angel might not be able to help us, but a more powerful angel, well, if something went wrong." "It might not just be me who dies," said Simon. Magnus looked pained, and Alec glanced down at the papers strewn across the table. Isabel put her hand on top of Simon's. "I can't believe we're actually sitting here talking about summoning an angel," she said. "My whole life we've sworn on the angel's name. We know our power comes from angels, but the idea of seeing one, I can't really imagine it. When I try to think about it, it's too big an idea." A silence fell across the table. There was a darkness in Magnus's eyes that made Simon wonder if he had ever seen an angel. He wondered whether he ought to ask, but was saved deciding by the buzzing of his cell phone. "One second," he muttered, and got to his feet. He flipped the phone open and leaned against one of the loft's pillars. It was a text, several, from Maya. "Good news. Luke is awake and talking. It looks like he's going to be okay." Relief poured over Simon in a wave. Finally, good news. He flipped the phone shut and reached for the ring on his hand. "Cleary?" Nothing. He swallowed his nerves. She was probably asleep. He looked up to find all three of the people at the table staring at him. "Who called?" Isabel asked. "It was Maya. She said Luke's up and talking, that he's going to be okay." There was a chatter of relieved voices, but Simon was still staring down at the ring on his hand. "She gave me an idea." Isabel had been on her feet, heading toward him. At that, she paused, looking worried. Simon supposed he didn't blame her. His ideas had been downright suicidal of late. "What is it?" she said. "What do we need to summon, Raziel?" "How much space?" Simon asked. Magnus paused over a book. "A mile around, at least. Water would be good, like Lake Lynn." "Luke's farm," Simon said. "Upstate, an hour or two away. It should be shut up now, but I know how to get there. And there's a lake. Not as big as Lynn, but..." Magnus closed the book he was holding. "That's not a bad idea, Seamus." "A few hours?" Isabel said, looking up at the clock. "We could be there by..." "Oh, no," said Magnus. He pushed the book away from him. "While your enthusiasm is boundless and impressive, Isabel, I'm too exhausted to properly cast the summoning spell at the moment. And this isn't something I want to take risks with. I think we can all agree." "So when?" Alec asked. "We need a few hours sleep at least," Magnus said. "I say we leave early afternoon." "Sherlock, sorry. Simon, call and see if you can borrow Jordan's truck in the meantime. And now," he pushed his papers to the side, "I'm going to sleep. Isabel, Simon, you're more than welcome to use the spare room again if you like." "Different spare rooms would be better," Alec muttered. Isabel looked at Simon with questioning dark eyes, but he was already reaching into his pocket for his phone. "Okay," he said. "I'll be back by noon. But for now, there's something important I have to do." In the daylight, Paris was a city of narrow, curving streets that opened out into wide avenues, mellow golden buildings with slate-colored roofs, and a glittering river that sliced across it like a dueling scar. Sebastian, despite his claim that he was going to prove to Clary that he had a plan, didn't say much as they made their way up a street lined with art galleries and stores selling dusty old books to reach the Quai des Grands Augustins by the river's edge. There was a cool wind coming off the Seine, and she shivered. Sebastian unwound the scarf from around his neck and handed it to her. It was a heathery black and white tweed, still warm from being wrapped around his neck. "Don't be stupid," he said. "You're cold. Put it on." Clary wound it around her neck. "Thanks," she said reflexively, and winced. There, she had thanked Sebastian. She waited for a bolt of lightning to shoot out of the clouds and strike her dead. But nothing happened. He gave her an odd look. "You all right? You look like you're going to sneeze." "I'm fine." The scarf smelled like citrusy cologne and boy. She wasn't sure what she'd thought it would smell like. They started to walk again. This time, Sebastian slowed his pace, walking alongside her, pausing to explain that neighborhoods in Paris were numbered, and they were crossing from the 6th into the 5th, the Latin Quarter, and that the bridge they could see spanning the river in the distance was the Pont Saint-Michel. There were a lot of young people walking past them, Clary noticed. Girls her age or older, impossibly stylish in tight-fitting pants and sky-high heels, long hair blowing in the wind off the Seine. Quite a few of them stopped to give Sebastian appreciative glances, which he didn't seem to notice. Jace, she thought, would have noticed. Sebastian was striking, with his icy white hair and black eyes. She had thought he was handsome the first time she'd met him, and he'd had his hair dyed black then. It hadn't suited him, really. He looked better like this. The pallor of his hair gave his skin some color, drew your eyes to the flush along his high cheekbones, the graceful shape of his face. His eyelashes were incredibly long, a shade darker than his hair, and curled slightly, just like Jocelyn's. So unfair. Why hadn't she gotten the curling lashes in the family? And why didn't he have a single freckle? "So," she said abruptly, cutting him off in the middle of a sentence, "what are we?" He gave her a sidelong look. "What do you mean, what are we?" "You said we're the last of the Morgensterns." "Morgenstern is a German name," said Clary. "So what are we? German? What's the story? Why aren't there any more but us?" "You don't know anything about Valentine's family?" Sebastian said. He had stopped next to the wall that ran along the Seine, beside the pavement. "Didn't your mother ever tell you anything?" "She's your mother, too, and no, she didn't. Valentine's not her favorite topic." "Shadowhunter names are compounded," said Sebastian slowly, and he climbed up on top of the wall. He reached a hand down, and after a moment she let him take hers and pull her up onto the wall beside him. The Seine ran gray-green below them, fly-speck tourist boats chugging by at a leisurely pace. "Fairchild, Lightwood, Whitelaw. Morgenstern means Morning Star. It's a German name, but the family was Swiss." "Was?" "Valentine was an only child," Sebastian said. "His father, our grandfather, was killed by downworlders, and our great-uncle died in a battle. He didn't have any children. This," he reached out and touched her hair, "is from the Fairchild side. There's English blood there. I look more like the Swiss side, like Valentine." "Do you know anything about our grandparents?" Clary asked, fascinated despite herself. Sebastian dropped his hand and leaped down off the wall. He held his hand up for her, and she took it, balancing as she leaped down. For a moment, she collided with his chest, hard and warm beneath his shirt. A passing girl shot her an amused, jealous look, and Clary pulled back hastily. She wanted to shout after the girl that Sebastian was her brother, and that she hated him anyway. She didn't. "I know nothing about our maternal grandparents," he said. "How could I?" His smile was crooked. "Come, I want to show you a favorite place of mine. Clary hung back. I thought you were going to prove to me that you had a plan. All in due time. Sebastian started to walk, and after a moment, she followed him. Find out his plan. Make nice until you do. Valentine's father was a lot like him, Sebastian went on. He put his faith in strength. We are God's chosen warriors. That's what he believed. Pain made you strong. Loss made you powerful. When he died, Valentine changed, Clary said. Luke told me. He loved his father, and he hated him. Something you might understand from knowing Jace. Valentine raised us as his father had raised him. You always return to what you know. But Jace, Clary said, Valentine taught him more than just fighting. He taught him languages and how to play the piano. That was Jocelyn's influence. Sebastian said her name unwillingly, as if he hated the sound of it. She thought Valentine ought to be able to talk about books, art, music, not just killing things. He passed that on to Jace. A wrought iron blue gate rose to their left. Sebastian ducked under it and beckoned Clary to follow him. She didn't have to duck, but went after him, her hands stuffed into her pockets. What about you? She asked. He held up his hands. They were unmistakably her mother's hands, dexterous, long-fingered, meant for holding a brush or a pen. I learned to play the instruments of war, he said, and paint in blood. I am not like Jace. They were in a narrow alley between two rows of buildings, made of the same golden stone as many of the other buildings of Paris, their roofs sparkling copper-green in the sunlight. The street underfoot was cobblestone, and there were no cars or motorcycles. To her left was a café, a wooden sign dangling from a wrought-iron pole, the only clue that there was any commercial business on this winding street. I like it here, said Sebastian, following her gaze, because it's as if you were in a past century. No noise of cars, no neon lights, just peaceful. Clary stared at him. He's lying, she thought. Sebastian doesn't have thoughts like this. Sebastian, who tried to burn Alicante to the ground, doesn't care about peaceful. She thought then of where he'd grown up. She'd never seen it, but Jace had described it to her. A small house, a cottage, really, in a valley outside Alicante. The nights would have been silent there, and the sky full of stars and night. But would he miss that? Could he? Was that the sort of emotion you could have when you weren't really even human? It doesn't bother you, she wanted to say. Being in the place the real Sebastian Verlac grew up and lived until you ended his life? Walking these streets, bearing his name, knowing that somewhere his aunt is grieving for him? And what did you mean when you said he wasn't supposed to fight back? His black eyes regarded her thoughtfully. He had a sense of humor, she knew. There was a streak of mordant wit in him that was sometimes not unlike Jace's. But he didn't smile. Come on, he said then, breaking off her reverie. This place has the best hot chocolate in Paris. Clary wasn't sure how she'd know if this were true or not, given that this was the first time she'd ever been to Paris. But once they sat down, she had to admit the hot chocolate was excellent. They made it at your table, which was small and wooden, as were the old-fashioned high-backed chairs, in a blue ceramic pot, using cream, chocolate powder, and sugar. The result was a cocoa so thick your spoon could stand up in it. They had croissants, too, and dunked them into the chocolate. You know, if you want another croissant, they'll bring you one, said Sebastian, leaning back in his chair. They were the youngest people in the place by decades, Clary noticed. You're attacking that one like a wolverine. I'm hungry, she shrugged. Look, if you want to talk to me, talk. Convince me. He leaned forward, his elbows on the table. She was reminded of looking into his eyes the night before, of noticing the silver ring around the iris of his eye. I was thinking about what you said last night. I was hallucinating last night. I don't remember what I said to you. You asked me who I belonged to, said Sebastian. Clary paused, with her cup of chocolate halfway to her mouth. I did?
Yeah.
His eyes studied her face intently. And I don't have an answer. She set her cup down, feeling suddenly, intensely uncomfortable. You don't have to belong to anyone, she said. It's just a figure of speech.
Well, let me ask you something now, Sebastian said. Do you think you can forgive me? I mean, do you think forgiveness is possible for someone like me?
I don't know. Clary gripped the edge of the table. I mean, I don't know much about forgiveness as a religious concept. Just your garden variety kind of forgiving people. She took a deep breath, knowing she was babbling. It was something in the steadiness of Sebastian's dark gaze on her, as if he actually expected her to give him the answers to the questions no one else could answer. I know you have to do things, to earn forgiveness, change yourself, confess, repent, make amends.
Amends, Sebastian echoed.
To make up for what you've done. She looked down at her mug. There was no making up for the things Sebastian had done, not in any way that made sense.
Ave atque vale,
Sebastian said, looking down at his mug of hot chocolate. Clary recognized the traditional words shadow hunters spoke over their dead.
Why are you saying that? I'm not dying.
You know, it's from a poem, he said, by Catullus. Frater ave atque vale. Hail and farewell, my brother. He speaks of ashes, of the rites of the dead, and his own grief for his brother. I was taught the poem young, but I didn't feel it. Either his grief, or his loss, or even the wondering what it would be like to die and to have one grieve you. He looked up at her sharply. What do you think it would have been like if Valentine had brought you up along with me? Would you have loved me? Clary was very glad she had put her cup down, because if she hadn't, she would have dropped it. Sebastian was looking at her not with any shyness or the sort of natural awkwardness that might be attendant on such a bizarre question, but as if she were a curious foreign life form. Well, she said, you're my brother. I would have loved you. I would have had to.
He kept looking at her with the same still, intent gaze. She wondered if she should ask him if he thought that meant he would have loved her too, like a sister. But she had a feeling he had no idea what that meant.
But Valentine didn't bring me up, she said. In fact, I killed him. She wasn't sure why she said it. Maybe she wanted to see if it was possible to upset him. After all, Jace had told her once that he thought Valentine might have been the only thing Sebastian had ever cared about. But he didn't blanch.
Actually, he said, the angel killed him, though it was because of you.
His fingers traced patterns on the worn tabletop. You know, when I first met you, in Idris, I had hopes. I thought you would be like me. And when you were nothing like me, I hated you. And then, when I was brought back and Jace told me what you did, I realized that I had been wrong. You are like me.
You said that last night, Clary said. But I'm not.
You killed our father, he said. His voice was soft. And you don't care. Never given it a second thought, have you? Valentine beat Jace bloody for the first 10 years of his life, and Jace still misses him, grieved for him, though they shared no blood at all. But he was your father, and you killed him, and you've never missed a night of sleep over it.
Clary stared at him with her mouth open. It was unfair, so unfair.
Valentine had never been a father to her, hadn't loved her, had been a monster who'd had to die. She had killed him because she'd had no choice. Unbidden in her mind rose the image of Valentine, driving his blade into Jace's chest, then holding him as he died. Valentine had wept over the son he'd murdered, but she had never cried for her father, had never even considered it.
"I'm right, aren't I?" said Sebastian. "Tell me I'm wrong. Tell me you're not like me."
Clary stared down at the cup of chocolate, now cold. She felt like a vortex had opened up inside her head and was sucking away her thoughts and words.
"I thought you thought Jace was like you," she said, finally in a choked voice. "I thought that's why you wanted him with you."
"I need Jace," said Sebastian. "But in his heart, he's not like me. You are." He stood up. He must have paid the bill at some point. Clary couldn't remember. "Come with me." He held his hand out. She stood up without taking it and retied his scarf mechanically. The chocolate she had drunk felt like acid churning in her stomach. She followed Sebastian out of the cafe and into the alley, where he stood looking up at the blue sky overhead. "I'm not like Valentine," Clary said, stopping next to him. "Our mother, your mother," he said, "hated me, hates me. You saw her. She tried to kill me. You want to tell me you take after your mother? Fine. Jocelyn Fairchild is ruthless. She always has been. She pretended to love our father for months, years maybe, so she could gather enough information on him to betray him. She engineered the uprising and watched all her husband's friends slaughtered. She stole your memories. Have you forgiven her? And when she ran from Idris, do you honestly think she ever planned to take me with her? She must have been relieved at the thought that I was dead." "She wasn't," Clary snapped. "She had a box that had your baby things in it. She used to take it out and cry over it, every year on your birthday. I know you have it in your room." Sebastian's thin, elegant lips twisted. He turned away from her and started walking down the alley. "Sebastian!" Clary called after him. "Sebastian, wait!" She wasn't sure why she wanted him to come back. Admittedly, she had no idea where she was or how to find her way back to the apartment, but it was more than that. She wanted to stand and fight, to prove she wasn't what he said she was. She raised her voice to a shout. "Jonathan Christopher Morgenstern!" He stopped and turned slowly, looking back over his shoulder at her. She walked toward him, and he watched her walk, his head cocked to the side, his black eyes narrow. "I bet you don't even know my middle name," she said. "Adele." There was a musicality to the way he said it, a familiarity that made her uncomfortable. "Clarissa Adele." She reached his side. "Why Adele? I never knew." "I don't know myself," he said. "I know Valentine never wanted you to be called Clarissa Adele. He wanted you to be called Serafina, after his mother, our grandmother." He turned around and started walking again, and this time she kept pace. "After our grandfather was killed, she died. Heart attack. Died of grief," Valentine always said. Clary thought of Amadis, who had never gotten over her first love, Stephen. Of the Inquisitor, her whole life dedicated to revenge. Of Jace's mother, cutting her wrists when her husband died. "Before I met the Nephilim, I would have said it was impossible to die of grief." Sebastian chuckled dryly. "We don't form attachments like mundanes do," he said. "Well, sometimes, surely. Not everyone is the same. But the bonds between us tend to be intense and unbreakable. That's why we do so badly with others not of our kind. Downworlders, mundanes." "My mother's marrying a downworlder," Clary said, stung. They had paused in front of a square stone building with blue-painted shutters almost at the end of the alley. He was Nephilim once, said Sebastian. And look at our father. Your mother betrayed him and left him, and he still spent the rest of his life waiting to find her again and convince her to come back to him. That whole closet full of clothes. He shook his head. But Valentine told Jace that love is a weakness, said Clary, that it would destroy you. Wouldn't you think that? If you spent half your life chasing a woman even though she hated your guts because you couldn't forget about her? If you had to remember that the person you loved best in the world stabbed you in the back and twisted the knife? He leaned in for a moment, close enough that when he spoke, his breath stirred her hair. Maybe you are more like our mother than our father. But what difference does it make? You have ruthlessness in your bones and ice in your heart, Clarissa. Don't tell me any differently. He spun away before she could answer him and mounted the front step of the blue-shuttered house. A strip of electric buzzers ran down the side of the wall beside the door, each with a name hand-scrawled on a placard beside it. He pressed the button beside the name Magdalena and waited. Eventually, a scratchy voice came through the speaker.
Qui est là? C'est la fils et la fille de Valentine, he said. Nous avions rendez-vous?
There was a pause, and then the buzzer sounded. Sebastian yanked the door open and held it open, politely letting Clary go before him. The stairs were wooden, as worn and smooth as the side of a ship. They trudged up them in silence to the top floor, where the door was propped slightly open onto the landing. Sebastian went through first, and Clary followed. She found herself in a large, airy, light space. The walls were white, as were the curtains. Through one window, she could see the street beyond, lined with restaurants and boutiques. Cars whizzed by, but the sound of them didn't seem to penetrate inside the apartment. The floor was polished wood, the furniture white-painted wood, or upholstered couches with colorful throw pillows. A section of the apartment was set up as a sort of studio. Light poured down from a skylight onto a long wooden table. There were easels, clothes tossed over them to obscure their contents. A paint-stained smock hung from a hook on the wall. Standing by the table was a woman. Clary would have guessed her age at about Jocelyn's, if there had not been several factors obscuring her age. She wore a shapeless black smock that hid her body. Only her white hands and her face and throat were visible. On each of her cheeks was carved a thick black rune, running from the outside corner of her eye to her lips. Clary had not seen the runes before, but she could sense their meaning. Power, skill, workmanship. The woman had thick, long auburn hair, falling in waves to her waist, and her eyes, when she raised them, were a peculiar flat orange color, like a dying flame. The woman clasped her hands in front of her smock loosely. In a nervous, melodic voice, she said,
Tu dois être Jonathan Morgenstern? Et elle, c'est ta sœur? Je pense que...
I am Jonathan Morgenstern, Sebastian said. And this is my sister, yes, Clarissa. Please speak English in front of her. She doesn't understand French. The woman cleared her throat.
My English is rusty. It has been years since I have used it.
It seems good enough to me. Clarissa, this is Sister Magdalena of the Iron Sisters. Clary was startled into speech.
But... I thought the Iron Sisters never left their fortress.
They don't, said Sebastian, unless they are disgraced by having their part in the uprising discovered. Who do you think armed the circle? He smiled at Magdalena mirthlessly. The Iron Sisters are makers, not fighters. But Magdalena fled the fortress before her part in the uprising could be discovered.
I had not seen another Nephilim in 15 years until your brother contacted me, said Magdalena.
It was hard to tell who she was looking at while she spoke. Her featureless eyes seemed to wander, but she was clearly not blind.
Is it true?
Do you have the material?
Sebastian reached into a pouch hanging from his weapons belt and took from it a chunk of what looked like quartz. He set it down on the long table, and a stray shaft of sunlight passing across the skylight lit it seemingly from within. Clary caught her breath. It was the Atomus from the junk shop in Prague. Magdalena drew in a hissing breath.
Pure Atomus, said Sebastian. No rune has ever touched it.
The Iron Sister came around the table and laid her hands upon the Atomus. Her hands, also scarred with multiple runes, trembled.
Atomus pure, she whispered. It has been years since I touched the holy material.
It is all yours to craft with, said Sebastian. When you are done, I shall pay you in more of it. That is, if you believe you can create what I asked for. Magdalena drew herself up. Am I not an Iron Sister? Did I not take the vows? Do my hands not shape the stuff of heaven? I can deliver what I promised, Valentine's son. Never doubt it.
Good to hear.
There was a trace of humor in Sebastian's voice.
I will return tonight, then.
You know how to summon me if you need to. Magdalena shook her head. All her attention was back on the glassine substance, the Atomus. She stroked it with her fingers.
Yes, you may go.
Sebastian nodded and took a step back. Clary hesitated. She wanted to seize the woman, ask her what Sebastian had demanded she do, ask her why she would ever have broken covenant law to work beside Valentine. Magdalena, as if sensing her hesitation, looked up and smiled thinly.
The two of you, she said.
And for a moment, Clary thought she was going to say that she did not understand why they were together, that she had heard that they had hated each other, that Jocelyn's daughter was a shadow hunter, while Valentine's son was a criminal. But she only shook her head.
Mon Dieu, she said, but you look just like your parents.
Chapter 16 Brothers and Sisters. When Clary and Sebastian returned to the apartment, the living room was empty, but there were dishes in the sink where there hadn't been before.
I thought you said Jace was asleep, she said to Sebastian, a note of accusation in her voice.
Sebastian shrugged. He was when I said it. There was a light mockery in his voice, but no serious unkindness. They had walked back from Magdalena's together, mostly in silence, but not a bad sort of silence. Clary had let her mind wander, only jerked back to reality on occasion by the realization that it was Sebastian she was walking beside.
I'm pretty sure I know where he is.
In his room? Clary started for the stairs.
No.
He moved in front of her. Come on, I'll show you. He headed up the stairs at a rapid pace and into the master bedroom, Clary on his heels. As she watched in puzzlement, he tapped the side of the wardrobe. It slid away, revealing a set of stairs behind it. Sebastian cast a smirk over his shoulder at her as she came up behind him.
You're kidding, she said. Secret stairs?
Don't tell me that's the strangest thing you've seen today. He took the stairs two at a time, and Clary, though bone-weary, followed him. The stairs curved around and opened out into a wide room with a polished wooden floor and high walls. All manner of weapons hung from the walls, just as they did in the training room in the Institute. Kinjals and chakrams, maces and swords and daggers, crossbows and brass knuckles, throwing stars and axes and samurai swords. Training circles were neatly painted on the floor. In the center of them stood Jace, his back to the door. He was shirtless and barefoot, in black warm-up pants, a knife in each of his hands. An image flashed in her head. Sebastian's bare back, scarred, with unmistakable whip stripes. Jace's was smooth, pale gold skin over muscle, marked only with the typical scars of a shadow hunter and the scratches her own nails had made last night. She felt herself flush, but her mind was still on the question. Why would Valentine have whipped one boy but not the other? "Jace," she said. He turned. He was clean. The silvery fluid was gone, and his gold hair was almost bronze dark, pasted damply to his head. His skin glistened with sweat. The expression on his face was guarded. "Where were you?" Sebastian went to the wall and began to examine the weapons there, running his bare hand along the blades. "I thought Clary might want to see Paris." "You could have left me a note," Jace said. "It isn't as if our situation is the safest, Jonathan. I'd rather not have to worry about Clary." "I followed him," Clary said. Jace turned and looked at her, and for a moment she caught a glimpse in his eyes of the boy and Idris who had shouted at her for spoiling all his careful plans to keep her safe. But this Jace was different. His hands didn't shake when he looked at her, and the pulse in his throat stayed steady. "You did what?" "I followed Sebastian," she said. "I was awake, and I wanted to see where he was going." She put her hands into her jeans pockets and looked at him defiantly. His eyes took her in, from her wind-mussed hair to her boots, and she felt the blood rise up in her face. Sweat shone along his collarbones and the ridges of his stomach muscles. His workout pants were folded over at the waist, showing the V of his hip bones. She remembered what it had felt like to have his arms around her, to be pressed close enough against him that she could feel every detail of his bones and muscles against her body. She felt a wave of embarrassment so acute it was dizzying. What made it worse was that Jace didn't seem in the least bit awkward, or as if the previous night had affected him as much as it had her. He seemed only annoyed. Annoyed and sweaty and hot. "Yeah, well," he said, "the next time you decide to sneak out of our magically warded apartment through a door that shouldn't really exist, leave a note." She raised her eyebrows. "Are you being sarcastic?" He threw one of his knives into the air and caught it. "Possibly." "I took Clary to see Magdalena," Sebastian said. He had taken a throwing star down from the wall and was examining it. "We brought the Adamus." Jace tossed the second knife into the air. He missed catching it this time, and it stuck point down into the floor. "You did?" "I did," Sebastian said. "And I told Clary the plan. I told her that we were planning to lure great demons here so we could destroy them." "But not how you planned to accomplish that," Clary said. "You never told me that part." "I thought it would be better to tell you with Jace here," said Sebastian. He snapped his wrist forward suddenly, and the throwing star flew toward Jace, who blocked it with a swift flick of his knife. It clattered to the ground. Sebastian whistled. "Fast," he commented. Clary whirled on her brother. "You could have hurt him!" "Anything that injures him injures me," said Sebastian. "I was showing you how much I trust him. Now I want you to trust us." His black eyes bored into her. "Adamus," he said. "The stuff I brought to the Iron Sister today. Do you know what's made out of it?" "Of course. Seraph blades. The demon towers of Alicante. Steely's. And the mortal cup." Clary shook her head. "The mortal cup is gold. I've seen it. Adamus dipped in gold. The mortal sword, too, has a hilt of the stuff. They say it's the material that palaces of heaven are built from. And it isn't easy to get hold of. Only the Iron Sisters can work the stuff, and only they're supposed to have access to it." "So why did you give some to Magdalena?" "So she could make a second cup," said Jace. A second mortal cup? Clary looked from one of them to the other, incredulous. But you can't just do that. Just make another mortal cup. If you could, the Clave wouldn't have panicked so much when the original mortal cup went missing. Valentine wouldn't have needed it so badly. It's a cup, said Jace. However crafted, it will always be a cup until the angel voluntarily pours his blood into it. That's what makes it what it is. And you think you can get Raziel to voluntarily pour his blood into a second cup for you? Cleary couldn't keep the razor edge of disbelief from her voice. Good luck. It's a trick, Clary, said Sebastian. You know how everything has an alliance? Seraphic or demonic? What the demons believe is that we want the demonic equivalent of Raziel. A demon great in power who will mix his blood with ours to create a new race of shadow hunters. Ones not bound by the law, or the covenant, or the rules of the Clave. You told them you want to make backward shadow hunters? Something like that. Sebastian laughed, raking fingers through his fair hair. Jace, do you want to help me explain? Valentine was a zealot, said Jace. He was wrong about a lot of things. He was wrong to consider killing shadow hunters. He was wrong about downworlders. But he wasn't wrong about the Clave or the Council. Every Inquisitor we've had has been corrupt. The laws handed down by the Angel are arbitrary and nonsensical, and their punishments are worse. The law is hard, but it is the law. How many times have you heard that? How many times have we had to duck and avoid the Clave and its laws even when we were trying to save them? Who put me in prison? The Inquisitor. Who put Simon in prison? The Clave. Who would have let him burn? Clary's heart had started to pound. Jace's voice, so familiar, saying these words, made her bones feel weak. He was right, and also wrong, as Valentine had been. But she wanted to believe him in a way she hadn't wanted to believe Valentine. Fine, she said. I understand the Clave is corrupt, but I don't see what it has to do with making deals with demons. Our mandate is to destroy demons, said Sebastian. But the Clave has been pouring all its energy into other tasks. The wards have been weakening, and more demons have been spilling into Earth. But the Clave turns a blind eye. We have opened a gate in the far north on Wrangel Island, and we will lure demons through it with the promise of this cup. Only, when they pour their blood into it, they will be destroyed. I have made deals like this with several greater demons. When Jace and I have killed them, the Clave will see we are a power to be reckoned with. They will have to listen to us. Clary stared. Killing greater demons isn't that easy. I did it earlier today, said Sebastian. Which is incidentally why neither of us is going to get in trouble for killing all those bodyguard demons. I killed their master. Clary looked from Jace to Sebastian and back again. Jace's eyes were cool, interested. Sebastian's gaze was more intense. It was as if he were trying to see into her head. Well, she said slowly, that's a lot to take in, and I don't like the idea of you putting yourselves in that kind of danger. But I'm glad you trusted me enough to tell me. I told you, Jay said. I told you she'd understand. I never said she wouldn't. Sebastian didn't take his eyes off Clary's face. She swallowed hard. I didn't sleep much last night, she said. I need to rest. Too bad, said Sebastian. I was going to ask if you wanted to climb the Eiffel Tower. His eyes were dark, unreadable. She couldn't tell if he were joking or not. Before she could say anything in reply, Jace's hand slid into hers. I'll go with you, he said. I didn't sleep that well myself. He nodded at Sebastian. See you for dinner. Sebastian made no reply. They were nearly to the steps when Sebastian called out, Clary! She turned around, drawing her hand out of Jace's. What? My scarf. He held out his hand for it. Oh, right. Taking a few steps toward him, she tugged with nervous fingers at the knotted cloth around her throat. After a moment of watching her, Sebastian made an impatient noise and stalked across the room toward her, his long legs covering the space between them quickly. She stiffened as he put his hands to her throat and deftly undid the knot with a few motions, then unwrapped the scarf. She thought for a moment that he lingered before unwrapping it fully, his fingers brushing her throat. She remembered him kissing her on the hill by the burned remains of the Fairchild Manor, and how she had felt as if she were falling into a dark and abandoned place, lost and terrified. She backed up hastily, and the scarf fell away from her neck as she turned. "Thanks for lending it to me," she said, and darted back to follow Jace down the stairs, not looking behind to see her brother watch her go, holding the scarf, a quizzical expression on his face. Simon stood among the dead leaves and looked up the path. Once more the human impulse to take a deep breath came on him. He was in Central Park, near the Shakespeare Garden. The trees had lost the last of their autumn luster, the gold and green and red turning to brown and black. Most of the branches were bare. He touched the ring on his finger again.
"Clary?"
Again there was no reply. His muscles felt as tense as strung wires. It had been too long since he had been able to raise her using the ring. He told himself over and over that she could be sleeping, but nothing could untie the terrible knot of tension in his stomach. The ring was his only connection to her, and right now it felt like nothing more than a hunk of dead metal. He dropped his hands to his sides and moved forward, up the path, past the statues and the benches inscribed with verses from Shakespeare's plays. The path turned to a curving right, and suddenly he could see her, sitting up, a head on a bench, looking away from him, her dark hair in a long braid down her back. She was very still, waiting, waiting for him. Simon straightened his back and walked toward her, even though every step felt as if it was weighted with lead. She heard him as he approached and turned around, her pale face going even paler as he sat down beside her.
"Simon," she said on an exhale of breath, "I wasn't sure you'd come."
"Hi, Rebecca," he said. She held out her hand and he took it, silently thanking the forethought that had made him put on gloves that morning, so that if he touched her, she wouldn't feel the chill of his skin. It hadn't been that long since he'd seen her last, maybe 4 months, but already she seemed like the photograph of someone he'd known a long time ago, even though everything about her was familiar. Her dark hair, her brown eyes, the same shape and color as his own, the spatter of freckles across her nose. She wore jeans, a bright yellow parka, and a green scarf with big yellow cotton flowers. Clary called Becky's style hippie chic. About half her clothes came from vintage stores, and the other half she sewed herself. As he squeezed her hand, her dark eyes filled with tears.
"Simon,"
she said, and put her arms around him and hugged him. He let her, patting her arms, her back, clumsily. When she pulled back, wiping at her eyes, she frowned.
"God, your face is cold," she said.
"You should wear a scarf." She looked at him accusingly.
"Anyway, where have you been?"
"I told you," he said. "I was staying with a friend." She gave a short bark of laughter.
"Okay, Simon, that so doesn't cut it," she said. "What the hell is going on?"
"Bex, I called home about Thanksgiving," Rebecca said, staring straight ahead at the trees. "You know, what train I should take, that sort of thing. And you know what Mom said? She said not to come home. There wasn't going to be any Thanksgiving. So I called you. You didn't pick up. I called Mom to find out where you were. She hung up on me. Just
hung up on me.
So I came home. That's when I saw the religious weirdness all over the door. I freaked out on Mom, and she told me you were dead. Dead. My own brother. She said you were dead, and a monster took your place.
What did you do?
I got the hell out of there, said Rebecca. Simon could tell she was trying to sound tough, but there was a thin, frightened edge to her voice. It was pretty clear Mom had lost it.
Oh, Simon said.
Rebecca and his mother had always shared a fraught relationship. Rebecca liked to refer to his mother as nuts or the crazy lady, but it was the first time he'd had the sense she really meant it.
Damn right, oh, Rebecca snapped. I was frantic. I texted you every 5 minutes. Finally, I get that crap text about you staying with a friend. Now you want to meet me here.
What the hell, Simon? How long has this been going on?
How long has what been going on?
What do you think? Mom being totally mental. Rebecca's small fingers picked at her scarf.
We have to do something. Talk to someone. Doctors. Get her on meds or something.
I didn't know what to do. Not without you. You're my brother.
I can't, Simon said.
I mean, I can't help you.
Her voice softened.
I know it sucks, and you're just in high school. But, Simon, we have to make these decisions together.
I mean, I can't help you get her on meds, he said. Or take her to the doctor.
Because she's right. I am a monster.
Rebecca's mouth dropped open.
Has she brainwashed you?
No.
Her voice wobbled.
You know, I thought maybe she'd hurt you, the way she was talking. But then I thought, no, she'd never do that, no matter what.
But if she did, if she laid a finger on you, Simon, so help me!
Simon couldn't take it anymore. He stripped off his glove and held his hand out to his sister. His sister, who'd held his hand on the beach when he was too small to toddle into the ocean unassisted. Who'd mopped blood off him after soccer practice, and tears off him after their father had died, and their mother was a zombie, lying in her room staring at the ceiling. Who'd read to him in his race car-shaped bed when he still wore footy pajamas.
I am the Lorax. I speak for the trees.
Who once accidentally shrunk all his clothes in the wash so they were doll size when she was trying to be domestic. Who packed his lunch when their mother didn't have time.
Rebecca, he thought. The last tie he had to cut.
Take my hand, he said.
She took it and winced.
You're so cold. Have you been sick?
You could say that.
He looked at her, willing her to sense something wrong with him, really wrong. But she only looked back at him with trusting brown eyes. He bit back a flare of impatience. It wasn't her fault. She didn't know.
Take my pulse, he said.
I don't know how to take someone's pulse, Simon. I'm an art history major.
He reached over and moved her fingers up to his wrist.
Press down. Do you feel anything?
For a moment, she was still, her bangs swinging over her forehead.
No. Am I supposed to?
Becky. He pulled his wrist back in frustration. There was nothing else for it. There was only one way.
Look at me, he said.
And when her eyes swung up to his face, he let his fangs snap out.
She screamed.
She screamed and fell off the bench onto the hard-packed dirt and leaves. Several passers-by looked at them curiously, but it was New York, and they didn't stop or stare, just kept moving. Simon felt wretched. This was what he'd wanted. But it was different, actually looking at her crouching there, so pale that her freckles stood out like ink blots, her hands over her mouth, just like it had been with his mother. He remembered telling Clary there was no worse feeling than not trusting the people you loved. He'd been wrong. Having the people you loved be afraid of you was worse. Rebecca, he said, and his voice broke. Becky. She shook her head, her hand still over her mouth. She was sitting in the dirt, her scarf trailing in the leaves. Under other circumstances, it might have been funny. Simon got down off the bench and knelt down next to her. His fangs were gone, but she was looking at him as if they were still there. Very hesitantly, he reached out and touched her on the shoulder. "Bex," he said, "I would never hurt you. I would never hurt Mom either. I just wanted to see you one last time to tell you I'm going away and you won't need to see me again. I'll leave you both alone. You can have Thanksgiving. I won't show up. I won't try to stay in touch. I won't..." "Simon." She grabbed his arm, and then she was pulling him toward her like a fish on a line. He half fell against her and she hugged him, her arms around him, and the last time she'd hugged him like this was the day of their father's funeral, when he'd cried in that way one cried when it didn't seem like it was ever going to stop. "I don't want to never see you again." "Oh," Simon said. He sat back in the dirt, so surprised that his mind had gone blank. Rebecca put her arms around him again, and he let himself lean against her, even though she was slighter than he was. She had held him up when they'd been children, and she could do it again. "I thought you wouldn't." "Why?" she said. "I'm a vampire," he said. It was weird, hearing it like that, out loud. "So there are vampires?" "And werewolves, and other weirder stuff. This just happened. I mean, I got attacked. I didn't choose it. But it doesn't matter. This is me now." "Do you..." Rebecca hesitated, and Simon sensed that this was the big question, the one that really mattered. "Bite people?" He thought about Isabel, then pushed the mental image hastily away. "And I bit a 13-year-old girl. And a dude. It's not as weird as it sounds." No, some things were not his sister's business. "I drink blood out of bottles. Animal blood. I don't hurt people." "Okay." She took a deep breath. "Okay. Is it? Okay, I mean." "Yeah. I love you," she said. She rubbed his back awkwardly. He felt something damp on his hand and looked down. She was crying. One of her tears had splashed onto his fingers, another one followed, and he closed his hand around it. He was shivering, but not from cold. Still, she pulled off her scarf and wrapped it around them both. "We'll figure it out," she said. "You're my little brother, you dumb idiot. I love you no matter what." They sat together, shoulder to shoulder, looking off into the shadowy spaces between the trees. It was bright in Jace's bedroom, midday sunlight pouring through the open windows. The moment Clary walked in, the heels of her boots clicked on the hardwood floor. Jace closed the door and locked it behind her. There was a clatter as he dropped the knives onto his bedside table. She began to turn, to ask him if he was all right, when he caught her around the waist and pulled her against him. The boots gave her extra height, but he still had to bend down to kiss her. His hands on her waist lifted her up and against him. A second later, his mouth was on hers, and she forgot all issues of height and awkwardness. He tasted like salt and fire. She tried to shut out everything but sensation, the familiar smell of his skin and sweat, the chill of his damp hair against her cheek, the shape of his shoulders and back under her hands, the way her body fit to his. He pulled her sweater over her head. Her t-shirt was short-sleeved, and she felt the heat coming off him against her skin. His lips parted hers, and she felt herself coming apart as his hand slid down to the top button on her jeans. It took all self-control she had to catch at his wrist with her hand and hold it still. "Jace," she said, "don't." He drew away, enough for her to see his face. His eyes were glassy, unfocused. His heart pounded against hers.
Why?
She squeezed her eyes shut. Last night, if I hadn't fainted, then I don't know what would have happened, and we were in the middle of a room full of people. Do you really think I want my first time with you, or any time with you, to be in front of a bunch of strangers?
That wasn't our fault, he said, pushing his fingers softly through her hair.
The scarred palm of his hand scratched her cheek lightly.
That silver stuff was fairy drugs, I told you. We were high. But I'm sober now, and you're sober now.
And Sebastian's upstairs, and I'm exhausted, and...
And this would be a terrible, terrible idea that both of us would regret.
And I don't feel like it, she lied.
You don't feel like it?
Disbelief colored his voice.
I'm sorry if no one's ever said that to you before, Jace, but no, I don't feel like it.
She looked pointedly down at his hand, still at the waistband of her jeans.
And now I feel like it even less.
He raised both eyebrows, but instead of saying anything, he simply let go of her.
Jace, I'm going to take a cold shower, he said, backing away from her.
His face was blank, unreadable. When the bathroom door slammed shut behind him, she walked over to the bed, neatly made up, no residual silver on the coverlet, and sank down, putting her head in her hands.
It wasn't as if she and Jace never fought. She'd always thought they argued about as much as normal couples did, usually good-naturedly, and they'd never been angry with each other in any significant way.
But there was something about the coldness at the back of this Jace's eyes that shook her, something far off and unreachable that made it harder than ever to push away the question always at the back of her mind.
Is any of the real Jace still in there? Is there anything left to save?
Now this is the law of the jungle, as old and as true as the sky. And the wolf that shall keep it may prosper, but the wolf that shall break it must die. As the creeper that girdles the tree trunk, the law runneth forward and back. For the strength of the pack is the wolf, and the strength of the wolf is the pack. Jordan stared blindly at the poem tacked to the wall of his bedroom. It was an old print that he'd found in a used bookstore, the words surrounded by an elaborate border of leaves. The poem was by Rudyard Kipling, and it so neatly encapsulated the rules by which werewolves lived, the law that bound their actions, that he wondered if Kipling hadn't been a downworlder himself, or at least known about the Accords. Jordan had felt compelled to buy the print and stick it up on his wall, though he'd never been one for poetry. He'd been pacing his apartment for the last hour, sometimes taking his phone out to see if Maya had texted, in between bouts of opening the refrigerator and staring into it to see if anything worth eating had appeared. It hadn't. But he didn't want to go out and get food in case she came to the apartment while he was out. He also took a shower, cleaned up the kitchen, tried to watch TV, and failed, and started the process of organizing all his DVDs by color. He was restless. Restless in the way he sometimes got before the full moon, knowing the change was coming, feeling the pull of the tides in his blood. But the moon was waning, not waxing, and it wasn't the change making him feel like crawling out of his skin. It was Maya. It was being without her, after almost 2 solid days in her company, never more than a few feet away from her. She'd gone without him to the police station, saying that now wasn't the time to upset the pack with a non-member, even though Luke was healing. There was no need for Jordan to come, she'd argued, since all she had to do was ask Luke if it was all right for Simon and Magnus to visit the farm tomorrow, and then she'd call up to the farm and warn any of the pack who might be staying up there to clear off the property. She was right, Jordan knew. There was no reason for him to go with her, but the moment she was gone, The restlessness kicked up inside him. Was she leaving because she was sick of being with him? Had she rethought and decided she'd been right about him before? And what was going on between them? Were they dating? Maybe you should have asked her before you slept together, genius, he told himself, and realized he was standing in front of the refrigerator again. Its contents hadn't changed. Bottles of blood, a defrosted pound of ground beef, and a dented apple. The key turned in the front door lock, and he jumped away from the refrigerator, spinning around. He looked down at himself. He was barefoot, in jeans and an old t-shirt. Why hadn't he taken the time while she'd been away to shave, look better, put on some cologne or something? He ran his hands quickly through his hair as Maya came into the living room, dropping his spare set of keys onto the coffee table. She had changed clothes into a soft pink sweater and jeans. Her cheeks were pink from the cold, her lips red, and her eyes bright. He wanted to kiss her so badly it hurt. Instead, he swallowed. So, how'd it go? Fine. Magnus can use the farm. I already texted him. She strolled over to him and leaned her elbows on the counter. I also told Luke what Raphael said about Maureen. I hope that's okay. Jordan was puzzled. Why do you think he needed to know? She seemed to deflate. Oh, God. Don't tell me I was supposed to keep it a secret. No, I was just wondering. Well, if there really is a rogue vampire cutting her way through Lower Manhattan, the pack should know. It's their territory. Besides, I wanted his advice about whether we should tell Simon or not. What about my advice? He was playing at sounding hurt, but there was a little part of him that meant it. They discussed it before, whether Jordan should tell his assignment that Maureen was out there and killing, or whether it would just be another burden to add to everything Simon was dealing with now. Jordan had come down on the side of not telling him. What could he do about it anyway? But Maya hadn't been so sure. She jumped up on top of the counter and swung around to face him. Even sitting down, she was taller than him this way, her brown eyes sparkling down into his. I wanted grown-up advice. He grabbed hold of her swinging legs and ran his hands up the seams of her jeans. I'm 18. Not grown up enough for you? She put her hands on his shoulders and flexed them, as if testing his muscles. Well, you've definitely grown. He pulled her down from the counter, catching her around the waist and kissing her. Fire sizzled up and down his veins as she kissed him back, her body melting against his. He slid his hands up into her hair, knocking her knitted cap off and letting her curls spring free. He kissed her neck as she pulled his shirt up over his head and ran her hands all over him, shoulders, back, arms, purring in her throat like a cat. He felt like a helium balloon, high from kissing her and light with relief. So she wasn't done with him after all. Jordy, she said. Wait. She almost never called him that, unless it was serious. His heartbeat, already wild, speeded up further. What's wrong? It's just, if every time we see each other we fall into bed, and I know I started it, I'm not blaming you or anything. It's just that maybe we should talk. He stared at her big dark eyes, the fluttery pulse in her throat, the flush on her cheeks. With an effort, he spoke evenly. Okay, what do you want to talk about? She just looked at him. After a moment, she shook her head and said, Nothing. She locked her hands behind his head and pulled him close, kissing him hard, fitting her body against his. Nothing at all. Clary didn't know how long it was before Jace came out of the bathroom, toweling off his wet hair. She looked up at him from where she was still sitting on the edge of the bed. He was sliding a blue cotton t-shirt on over smooth golden skin marked with white scars. She darted her eyes away as he came across the room and sat down next to her on the bed, smelling strongly of soap. "I'm sorry," he said. Now she did look at him, in surprise. She had wondered if he was capable of being sorry in his current state. His expression was grave, a little curious, but not insincere.
"Wow," she said. "That cold shower must have been brutal."
His lips quirked up at the side, but his expression grew serious again almost immediately. He put his hand under her chin. "I shouldn't have pushed you. It's just 10 weeks ago, just holding each other would have been unthinkable."
"I know."
He cupped her face in his hands, his long fingers cool against her cheeks, tilting her face up. He was looking down at her, and everything about him was so familiar. The pale gold irises of his eyes, the scar on his cheek, the full lower lip, the slight chip in his tooth that saved his looks from being so perfect that they were annoying. And yet somehow, it was like coming back to a house she had lived in as a child, and knowing that though the exterior might look the same, a different family lived there now. "I never cared," he said. "I wanted you anyway. I always wanted you. Nothing mattered to me but you. Not ever." Clary swallowed. Her stomach fluttered. Not just with the usual butterflies she felt around Jace, but with real uneasiness.
"But Jace, that's not true. You cared about your family. And I always thought you were proud of being Nephilim, one of the angels."
"Proud?" he said. "To be half angel, half human, you're always conscious of your own inadequacy. You're not an angel. You're not beloved of heaven. Raziel doesn't care about us. We can't even pray to him. We pray to nothing. We pray for nothing. Remember when I told you I thought I had demon blood? Because it explained why I felt the way I did about you. It was a relief in a way, thinking that. I've never been an angel, never even close. Well," he added, "maybe the fallen kind. Fallen angels are demons." "I don't want to be Nephilim," said Jace. "I want to be something else, stronger, faster, better than human, but different. Not subservient to the laws of an angel who couldn't care less about us. Free." He ran his hand through a curl of her hair. "I'm happy now, Clary. Doesn't that make a difference?"
"I thought we were happy together," Clary said.
"I've always been happy with you," he said. "But I never thought I deserved it."
"And now you do?"
"And now that feeling is gone," he said. "All I know is that I love you, and for the first time, that's good enough." She closed her eyes. A moment later, he was kissing her again. Very softly this time, his mouth tracing the shape of hers. She felt herself go pliant under his hands. She sensed it as his breathing quickened and her own pulse jumped. His hands stroked down through her hair, over her back, to her waist. His touch was comforting, the feel of his heartbeat against hers like familiar music, and if the key was slightly different, with her eyes closed, she couldn't tell. Their blood was the same, under the skin, she thought, as the Seely Queen had said. Her heart raced when his did, had nearly stopped when his had. If she had to do it all again, she thought, under the pitiless gaze of Raziel, she would have done the same thing. This time he drew back, letting his fingers linger on her cheek, her lips. "I want what you want," he said, "whenever you want it." Clary felt a shudder go down her spine. The words were simple, but there was a dangerous and seductive invitation to the fall of his voice. "Whatever you want, whenever you want it." His hand smoothed down her hair to her back, lingering at her waist. She swallowed. There was only so much that she was going to be able to hold back.
"Read to me," she said suddenly.
He blinked down at her.
"What?"
She was looking past him, at the books on his nightstand. "It's a lot to process," she said. "What Sebastian said, what happened last night, everything. I need to sleep, but I'm too keyed up. When I was young and I couldn't sleep, my mother used to read to me to relax me."
"And I remind you of your mother now?"
"I have got to look into a manlier cologne." "No, it's just, I thought it would be nice." He scooted back against the pillows, reaching for the stack of books by the bed. "Anything particular you want to hear?" With a flourish, he picked up the book on top of the stack. It looked old, leather-bound, the title stamped in gold on the front. A Tale of Two Cities. Dickens is always promising. "I've read that before, for school," Clary recalled. She scooted up on the pillows beside Jace. "But I don't remember any of it, so I wouldn't mind hearing it again." "Excellent. I've been told I have a lovely melodic reading voice." He flipped the book open to the front page, where the title was printed in ornate script. Across from it was a long dedication, the ink faded now and barely legible, though Clary could make out the signature. "With hope at last, William Herondale." "Some ancestor of yours?" Clary said, brushing her finger against the page. "Yes. Odd that Valentine had it. My father must have given it to him." Jace opened to a random page and began to read. He unshaded his face after a little while and spoke steadily. "Don't be afraid to hear me. Don't shrink from anything I say. I am like one who died young. All my life might have been. No, Mr. Carton, I am sure that the best part of it might still be. I am sure that you might be much, much worthier of yourself." "Oh, I do remember this story now," Clary said. "Love triangle. She picks the boring guy." Jace chuckled softly. "Boring to you. Who can say what got Victorian ladies hot beneath the petticoats?" "It's true, you know." "What, about the petticoats?" "No, that you have a lovely reading voice." Clary turned her face against his shoulder. It was times like this, more than when he was kissing her, that hurt. Times when he could have been her Jace, as long as she kept her eyes closed. "All that and Abs of Steel," Jace said, turning another page. "What more could you ask for?" Chapter 17. Valediction. As I strolled down along the quay, all in the lateness of the day, I heard a lovely maiden say, "Alack, for I can get no play." A minstrel boy heard what she said, and straight he rushed to her aid. "Do we have to keep listening to this waily music?" Isabel demanded, her booted foot tapping against the dashboard of Jordan's truck. "I happen to like this waily music, my girl. And since I'm driving, I get to choose," Magnus said loftily. He was indeed driving. Simon had been surprised that he knew how, though he wasn't sure why. Magnus had been alive for ages. Surely he had found time to squeeze in a few weeks of driver's ed. Although, Simon couldn't help wondering what birth date was on his license. Isabel rolled her eyes, probably because there wasn't enough room to do much else in the cab of the truck, with all four of them crammed together on the bench seat. Simon honestly hadn't expected her to come. He hadn't expected anyone to come to the farm with him and Magnus, though Alec had insisted on coming as well, much to Magnus's annoyance as he considered the whole enterprise too dangerous. And then, just as Magnus had revved up the engine of the truck, Isabel had come banging down the stairs of his apartment building and thrown herself through the front door, panting and out of breath. "I'm coming too," she'd announced. And that was that. No one could budge or dissuade her. She wouldn't look at Simon as she insisted, or explained why she wanted to come. But she did, and here she was. She was wearing jeans and a purple suede jacket she must have stolen out of Magnus's closet. Her weapons belt was slung around her slim hips. She was mashed up against Simon, whose other side was crushed against the car door. A strand of her hair was flying free and tickling his face. "What is this, anyway?" Alex said, frowning at the CD player, which was playing music, although without a CD in it. Magnus had simply tapped the sound system with a blue flashing finger, and it had started playing. "Some fairy band?" Magnus didn't answer, but the music swelled louder. Tamira went she straight away and did her ebon hair array, and for her gown she much did pay. Then down she walked along the street, a handsome lad she chanced to meet, and sore by dawn were her dainty feet, but all the boys were gay. Isabel snorted, "All the boys are gay. In this truck, anyway. Well, not you, Simon." "You noticed?" said Simon.
"I think of myself as a freewheeling bisexual," added Magnus.
"Please, never say those words in front of my parents," said Alec. "Especially my father."
"I thought your parents were okay with, you know, coming out," Simon said, leaning around Isabel to look at Alec, who was, as he often was, scowling and pushing his floppy dark hair out of his eyes. Aside from the occasional exchange, Simon had never talked to Alec much. He wasn't an easy person to get to know. But Simon admitted to himself, his own recent estrangement from his mother made him more curious about Alec's answer than he would have been otherwise.
"My mother seems to have accepted it," Alec said. "But my father, no, not really. Once he asked me what I thought had turned me gay." Simon felt Isabel tense next to him.
"Turned you gay?"
She sounded incredulous.
"Alec, you didn't tell me that."
"I hope you told him you were bitten by a gay spider," said Simon. Magnus snorted. Isabel looked confused.
"I've read Magnus's stash of comics," said Alec, "so I actually know what you're talking about."
A small smile played around his mouth.
"So would that give me the proportional gayness of a spider?"
"Only if it was a really gay spider," said Magnus, and he yelled as Alec punched him in the arm.
"Ow! Okay, never mind."
"Well, whatever," said Isabel, obviously annoyed not to get the joke. "It's not like Dad's ever coming back from Idris anyway." Alec sighed. "Sorry to wreck your vision of our happy family. I know you want to think Dad's fine with me being gay, but he's not."
"But if you don't tell me when people say things like that to you, or do things to hurt you, then how can I help you?"
Simon could feel Isabel's agitation vibrating through her body.
"How can I..." "Is," Alec said tiredly. "It's not like it's one big bad thing. It's a lot of little invisible things.
When Magnus and I were traveling, and I'd call from the road, Dad never asked how he was. When I get up to talk in Clave meetings, no one listens, and I don't know if that's because I'm young or if it's because of something else. I saw Mom talking to a friend about her grandchildren, and the second I walked into the room, they shut up. Irina Cartwright told me it was a pity no one would ever inherit my blue eyes now." He shrugged and looked toward Magnus, who took a hand off the wheel for a moment to place it on Alex. "It's not like a stab wound you can protect me from. It's a million little paper cuts every day."
"Alec," Isabel began, but before she could say anything more, the sign for the turnoff loomed up ahead, a wooden placard in the shape of an arrow with the words, "Three Arrows Farm," painted on it in block lettering. Simon remembered Luke kneeling on the farmhouse floor, painstakingly spelling out the words in black paint, while Clary added the now weather-faded and almost invisible pattern of flowers along the bottom. "Turn left," he said, flinging his arm out and nearly hitting Alec. "Magnus, we're here."